Hi, everybody. Dennis Prager here. And if you want a controversial subject, here it comes. Genetically modified food. And I have on the line a professor of agricultural economics at Oklahoma State University, Jason Lusk. Professor Lusk is author of Food Police, a well-fed manifesto about the politics of your plate. He and a co-author, Henry Miller, wrote a piece this week for the New York Times. I was actually surprised that the New York Times would publish it. I would think that the New York Times would be against genetically modified wheat. And I have a whole bunch of questions, and I know that a fair number of you listeners are against genetically modified food. So here is your chance to challenge somebody who knows the issue well. Professor Lusk, welcome to the Dennis Prager Show.
Hi, Dennis. Thanks for having me on.
I'm just curious, how was the reaction to your New York Times piece?
Well, I guess anybody can go read the comments that are online, and I think probably running about 9-1 negative to positive. So, you know, most of them are pretty vehemently opposed to the perspectives I have in there, although I'd say a lot of the comments are sort of ad hominem attacks that somehow I'm paid off by Monsanto or these big agribusiness.
Yeah, well, that happens whenever anything that annoys certain people. Well, he works for, if anybody says that perhaps global warming is not induced by human conduct and is not going to lead to catastrophe, then they're clearly working for oil companies. So that happens. I'm used to hearing that. But if we had a vote in this country, I'm not saying nobody knows the answer, but what would you surmise? Do you think that the country would vote for genetically modified wheat or against it?
My guess is most people, just based on their gut intuition, would vote against it. But I also think that, you know, when people are given information about sort of the facts and the details, that they would become much more accepting. And the reason I say that is because we had something like that happen out in California back in November, where they were voting not to ban, for example, GMOs, but whether to add mandatory labels. And before it really became a big issue, you know, there are lots of polls, and you know, they were saying things like 90% of people want to vote to require mandatory labels. But then when you look at the actual voting outcome, it actually failed. It was close, but it failed by less than half. And so it was a huge change in the time span of 2 to 3 months, largely in response to a lot of the information that people received about this issue that is so controversial and for which there is so much misinformation.
Well here's the thing that you wrote about that I don't understand. You say more than 90% of the nation's corn and soybean acres are now planted with seeds genetically engineered to resist insects, herbicides, herbicides, or both. Now, why has it been okay to genetically modify corn and soybeans, but not wheat?
Yeah, well, the differences in those commodities sort of arose in large part sort of the politics of the different commodities. So there is no difference in terms of food safety or anything like that.
Forgive me. Yeah. So just on that basis, you write in your article that the government is lagging in terms of approving genetically modified wheat. Why didn't it lag on corn and soybeans?
Right. So, as I say, it kind of gets a little bit to the politics of the different commodities and the positions of our trading partners. So some people have this idea that GMOs are somehow banned in Europe, and that's just not true. Europe, in fact, imports a large amount of soybeans from the United States that are genetically modified. But what happens to those soybeans is that they are mainly used in animal feed, and those products are not required to have a label in Europe. But wheat, for example, often is used in products that go more towards direct human consumption, like bread or pasta. And even though there's no difference in health safety risk, that difference has political ramifications for our trading partners like Japan and like Europe that are a little more hostile to these technologies. And so it's that fear about our trading partners. And we export a lot of our wheat, about half. So people are much more sensitive about what our trading partners think about some of these issues.
All right, so I want to know why they're sensitive about it. That's the whole point. And those of you listening, if you're sensitive, say the least, about genetically modified wheat or any other food, give me a call. We'll be back with Professor Lusk in a moment on the Dennis Prager Show. Hi, everybody. Dennis Prager, I'm a professor of agricultural economics, Oklahoma State University. He's written a piece for the New York Times, and it's titled, We Need GMO Wheat, which is genetically modified organism wheat. Is that correct? The O stands for organism?
That's right.
And it is controversial in Europe and, in fact, not allowed, and we allow it in soybeans and corn, and that is imported, but largely because that's the stuff that animals eat, whereas when it comes to what we eat, there's a lot of opposition to genetically modified wheat, as an example. Before we talk about the issue of dangers, and I have a lot of people calling in who do believe it's dangerous, and I don't know enough to have a position, but I'm open to it being a good thing. Tell me and my listeners, what are the advantages? Before we assess the dangers issue, what are the advantages of genetically modified, let us say, wheat?
Right. So there are advantages that are currently being realized. Well, I guess they're not currently, but that are in the pipeline to be realized. And there are also all kinds of advantages that could come down the pipeline if we don't close the door to this technology. So the ones that exist now are the main commodities that use genetic engineering. What they do is they are resistant to either herbicides or insecticides. So what that does for a farmer is that they don't have to be out in their field spraying insecticides all over their field for corn, for example, if it's been genetically engineered to be resistant to certain pests like, you know, corn borers or something like that. So there's pretty good evidence that the amount of insecticide use has gone way down on farms that have adopted genetically engineered corn, for example. And then the herbicide issue is also very beneficial because it allows farmers to treat weeds much more easily, so they can spray a herbicide over the whole field. It doesn't kill the corn or soybeans, or in this case, you know, it would be wheat, but it does kill the weeds, and so that allows potentially for higher yields, but it also saves labor for the farmer, and it also has allowed farmers to switch towards conservation tillage practices, so they don't have to go out and be replowing that field all the time. They can kill the weeds by spraying some of the herbicide. So, you know, whether it's been beneficial to farmers or not, all you have to do is look at what they've chosen. So as you indicated early on, over 90% of corn and soybean acres are genetically modified. Nobody's holding a gun to these farmers' heads. In fact, they're paying a little extra premium for the genetically engineered corn and soybeans. And so, you know, they're adopting it because it's easier for them, it saves them time, and in a lot of cases saves them money. So the real advantage is on the farm side. I think there's some environmental advantages as well. And for food consumers like you and I, the main advantage is lower food prices.
Now, what about the issue of water?
Yeah, so I think this is one of the technologies that's sort of in the pipeline of development. And when we think about biotechnology, there are all kinds of really interesting applications, and this is one, and that's the ability to find certain breeds of wheat or breeds of closely related relatives and to breed characteristics into wheat, for example, that in this case make it less sensitive to drought, that need less water, that can still produce a hardy yield without needing nearly as much water. And that could be a really big benefit to farmers out in this part of the country.
Well, that would change the world. I mean yeah. That alone, if that's true, when you say in the pipeline, mm-hmm. Do you mean we already have it? Or they're working on it?
They're working on it. And I think this is an important point for your listeners to understand. You know, this is not just like Monsanto, for example, the evil empire, according to many. There are a lot of nonprofit groups. These are universities. Bill and Melinda Gates, for example, they fund research on biotechnology that are looking at exactly these issues. And it takes a long time to develop. It's not like we have a drought today, and so tomorrow we get a new variety of wheat. You know, these take years to develop, and they are in the pipeline. And other applications relate to things like Like out in Hawaii, they use genetically engineered papaya because the papaya industry there was devastated due to this virus that started attacking the trees, and they found a variety that was resistant to this virus. And I think some of the most interesting applications are also in the developing countries like Africa, where there are nonprofits and companies trying to figure out how to take staple crops like cassava or sweet potatoes and make them more nutrient-rich and breed in vitamins, for example, that are really in short supply in a lot of those countries.
Let me ask you, do you have any, and I'm truly neutral on this issue, if I didn't have any sympathy for what you were saying, I wouldn't have you on, and if I were totally opposed, on the other hand, I don't, you know, well, I have people I'm totally opposed to, but in any event, I'm in the middle because I just don't know enough. But let me just ask you, do you believe there's any downside to genetically modified foods?
So I think the issue over the safety of the crops that are at least on the market, that I can understand how people would be concerned, because people, it's sort of in our human nature to be concerned about new foods. I mean, you can go back to look at how Europeans responded when they first saw potatoes or Indian corn, or how we responded to things like pasteurization of milk or microwave ovens. So I think it's just sort of human nature to be skeptical of new foods and new food varieties. So what you want to do, I think, in those cases is to try to look and turn to the scientific evidence. And I'll wait on that in just a minute, because I assume we'll get to it. But that issue is not one that's concerning to me. I think when I talk to people who mention concerns, I don't necessarily agree with the magnitude, but there are people that are worried about, for example, too much consolidation in the seed sector. So Monsanto and Bayer and a few other companies own a lot of the technology that's related to seed, and people have concerns about that. I don't think that's an illegitimate concern, but I do think you can be for biotechnology without being for Monsanto. And I think there are some potentials for some environmental risks, but I think with careful management, we can mitigate some of the worst potential consequences there.
All right, please stay on with me, and I know a lot of you want to challenge the professor, and I'm going to take your calls when we come back. If what he said is true, that there is a healthy wheat that doesn't need nearly as much water, do you realize what that could do for the world? I mean, so I don't want to dismiss this too easily. Back in a moment. Hello, my friends. I'm speaking to Professor Jason Lusk, a professor of agricultural economics, Oklahoma State University, author of Food Police. And we're discussing his column in the New York Times, We Need GMO, Genetically Modified Wheat. And let me take some calls here. And I've asked the professor if he'll stay over, and he's graciously consented to do so. Because I want to hear those of you who have rational objections, because if there aren't powerful objections, I am well aware of the good. I am, well, not well aware, I'm aware of the good, and it seems immense that the genetically modified foods can do. And so I need to hear the downside. And Dan in Redondo Beach, California, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, Dennis. Thanks for having me.
Right.
I have had health problems for 10 or 15 years, and I'm a young guy. I've seen health problems throughout my family and friends. Weird things, celiac disease, things associated with wheat. I truly believe in 10, 15, 20 years, we're going to realize that genetically modifying these foods, just as corn is nowhere near what the original maize was, that it's going to show the impact it does have on our health. I totally understand the benefits of it, and it splits me, because I see how many people it can help. But at the same time, I've gone through so much, and I've studied health so much. I just believe God made these things a certain way, and we should not be messing with them. I don't see why we can't have a choice between, if you want genetically modified, you have no problem with it, choose it. If you don't want it, then you have that option to not choose it.
Well, that sounds rational. What do you say to that, Professor?
So that's a good question. There's a lot wrapped up in there. So the first practical question is, if you want to avoid genetically modified crops, organics are certified to be produced without GMOs. So you can buy organic and avoid these kind of crops if you'd like. I'd like to sort of address this question that, you know, this is sort of how God made things. And, you know, this is coming from someone who is a Christian. You know, we've been modifying the plants and animals around us since Adam spit the first seed on the ground. I mean, if you go back and look at what the original varieties of corn look like, or even wheat, they're absolutely nothing like what we have available to us now. And the reason things are different is because we as humans interacted with nature, and, you know, God gave us a mind to think about how to use things and how to use our human ingenuity. And this, we have wonderful things around us now, like cars and cell phones and microwave ovens that God didn't give us directly, but he allowed us the ability to figure out how to make our lives better and interact with it, ways to do that.
Okay, excellence. Please stay on as he is, and you're calling in. Stay on. Back after the news. Hello, my friends, and welcome to or back to the Dennis Prager Show. Coming to you from Washington, I was at the National Prayer Breakfast today. I spoke there last night. Today is the big breakfast, and I gave you my report earlier. If you don't get a chance to hear all 3 hours of the show, that's why we have Pragertopia, which I highly recommend to you. It is $5 a month, $5 less or more, I should say, than free. Pragertopia.com. And I gave a review of what happened at the National Prayer Breakfast. And now I've asked, and I don't do this often, but I've asked him to stay on the line because it's such an important subject, and he is a professional voice in the matter. He is a professor at Oklahoma State University of Agricultural Economics, Jason Lusk. He has co-authored a piece in the New York Times, "We Need Genetically Modified Wheat." The piece is up at DennisPrager.com, and I might and happily mention that he is the author as well of a book, "Food Police: A Well-Fed Manifesto About the Politics of Your Plate." And so, thank you for holding on there, Professor Lusk. And the advantages of genetically modified food are huge. We had a caller at the end of the last hour who spoke about the various illnesses that he and family members had that he apparently feels have come from genetically modified foods. The reason that I in this regard, I tend to side with you is that I have heard so often of people well-intentioned who have blamed, for example, silicone breast implants on diseases, which after many years of bankrupting a number of companies ended up not to be true. And I understand why people might feel it, because if you got a breast implant and then you had various diseases that you couldn't find the genesis of, you could say, oh, that's what it is. Or in this case, genetically modified corn. And you answered the other thing. Well, didn't God make wheat this way or make corn that way? And while I can't answer fully from your perspective of knowledge, I can say again that's an argument that I hear parents of deaf children who say, well, God made my child deaf. Why should I have a cochlear implant and give my child hearing? God, after all, wanted my child deaf. Or God wanted my nose in such a way, why would anybody, God made your nose in such a way, why would you ever have a nose job? So I never have bought the God made stuff this way argument. It doesn't, God, as you said, gave us brains, and you mentioned that you're a religious person, a Christian, I'm a religious person, a Jew, and so I don't think God has a problem with us modifying nature.
Yeah, and I think if anything, you know, I think one of the things, thinking about a religious perspective, is that we want to do things that help others, that make other people better off. And my fear about some of these issues, you know, let's take another scientific issue that there was a lot of paranoia about, and that was autism and vaccines. That there was this group of people, some well-known celebrities, that were making this case that vaccines were causing autism, and you know, it spread around like wildfire, and as a result, you got a lot of people that are catching things like that they would have never had before, and as a result, did a lot more harm than good when there was really no good scientific evidence to suggest that link was there. And I think what I'm trying to point out with some of the arguments on biotechnology too is even though I can understand where people are coming from and their aversion, we got to look at the consequences. And if we turn our backs on some of these technologies, food will become more expensive, and that's a big detriment to people, not necessarily in this country, although there are people in this country that have a hard time eating, but particularly some of the people that live in the most impoverished countries in the world. So that's one of the reasons I look somewhat favorably on these issues. I see it as a way of actually really helping our fellow man.
And us, I might add, because you point out, again, I read your article very carefully, much of the nation's wheat crop, you write, comes from a section of the Central Plains that sits atop the Ogallala Aquifer, which is rapidly being depleted. The direst warnings suggest that at current rates of use, in 50 years, only 30% of its water will remain. Farmers who have relied on the aquifer may face tougher restrictions on use or be forced to change their farming practices. So genetically modified wheat uses how much less water?
Yeah, so this is one of those varieties, as I say, that's sort of in the development pipeline. So, you know, we don't have, I don't think at this standpoint, a really good handle on exactly what kind of reduction we could be talking about. But it has been developed. I mean, they have some varieties, and it's a matter of trying to work them into, you know, experimental test plots so we can see exactly what we're dealing with. But there is evidence of some crops that have been looked at in Egypt, for example, some Egyptian scientists that do suggest some pretty significant reductions in water usage. So I don't mean to be evasive. It's just I can't remember the statistics right off the top of my head.
That's all right. Okay, let me go to some calls, though, because I want to get people who have a different view than you, obviously. And let's go to Dunedin, Florida, and Tim. Hi, Tim. You're on with Professor Jason Lusk.
Hi, Dennis. I'm a great admirer of you, and I've loved your show for several years now. And it's pronounced
Thank
Dunedin.
You very much.
I'm also a biologist.
Oh, good. I want to know that. I knew I was wrong. I knew it. Dunedin. Okay.
I just want to comment on the idea that genetically engineering something and selecting for particular traits within a species is a little bit different. And the Bible talks about not mixing things. You're not supposed to mix your field, two different kinds of seeds. You're not supposed to mix animals. So genetic material, genetic modification seems more like it's mixing. My concern with genetic modification is that the yields might not be the same year for year. Might there be drop-offs in yields that you wouldn't expect if you were to just plant natural seed, like farmers have been doing for several years. If that is the case, then we can end up finding ourselves being held hostage to large corporate interest in keeping our food supply going, which could be a lot scarier than Obamacare. That's it.
Yeah. So,
all right. Thank you.
So
Professor.
I'd push back really strongly on this idea that there is somehow a natural seed, you know, or there's just this one variety. So, I mean, since the early 1900s, corn farmers have been planting all kinds of hybrids, and you know, farmers and seed companies have been working for hundreds of years on finding newer, higher yield varieties. So I don't really know what people are talking about when they mean like natural seed. There really is no such thing. But this idea of like, you know, yield dropping. I mean, again, nobody's holding a gun to these farmers' heads, and it's also not true that they don't have choice. So any farmer that's out there can choose to plant GM or non-GM. There are lots of varieties on the market, and they can select between them. And you have seen periods where, you know, people have planted more, you know, genetically engineered soybeans, for example, in one year than the next. And so, you know, sometimes people make different decisions and they switch back and forth. So, I think I could be somewhat sympathetic to this idea that we don't want corporate interest controlling the food supply. But I think my argument to that is, well, then let's make it not so hard for there to be competition in the sector. And one of the things that happens when we have a lot of really onerous regulations on this sector is that it makes it actually easier for really big seed companies to maintain their market power, because they don't have to compete against these small companies that don't have teams of lawyers to lobby their position in Washington and get their seeds introduced. So, you know, my answer to that is not to do away with biotechnology, but to make sure that there aren't barriers to entry, that people, small companies, can enter and compete with those big guys.
The caller hung up not out of any rudeness, just he had asked his question and just wanted to hear a response. But I would just want to mention to him as well that there is an area where I am close to certain that I do support genetically modified, and that is in the case of rice in places like the Philippines, wherein the lack of vitamin A in the diets of poor children causes massive death and massive blindness, whereas just one modification of putting in effect vitamin A into rice would save millions of children's of lives in the third world and prevent their blindness. And it would seem to me you'd have to have a very, very strong argument about its dangers in order to make an argument against all the good that that could do. I'll get your response on that, Professor. We have one more segment with Professor Jason Lusk. His piece in the New York Times is up at DennisPrager.com. The case for GMO wheat. You're listening to The Dennis Prager Show. All right, everybody, the professor had to go. I kept him 15 minutes more, 20 minutes more than we had originally bargained for, so he was quite generous. I will revisit the subject. Let me just say a few things, and I won't be able to take your calls because I can't answer the comments that you have directed to the professor. But let me just tell you philosophically, since I don't know the chemistry of genetically modified foods, and I suspect that the vast majority of you don't either, and you'd have to study this. This is a field of science that you'd have to study. See, I would need to be shown, for example, in order to go against it, since I know the advantages, I would need to know what the disadvantage is, and then you weigh. See, we think that scientists are the people who should tell us what to do. Scientists should do only one thing: tell us the science. Then we, based on philosophy of life, based on our values, then we will make the decision. When you leave it to experts to tell you what to do, you will very often, in fact, more often than not, get the wrong advice. My classic example is the fire departments that tell schools to keep school doors and classes all closed in case there's a fire. I can't think of a more foolish piece of advice. The number of school fires is so infinitesimally small that to keep rooms overly hot by keeping their doors closed is just a bad piece of advice. I want the fire department to tell me all the facts and then make me, the non-fire person, if you will, decide. So Bonnie, Richard, Sherry, Craig, John, I can't take your call because the professor's not on, but thank you very, very much for calling. I read all your objections, and they seem to be, in some cases, science-based, and I would love to have gotten his answers. In some cases, they're philosophical, and I understand that. To me, the philosophical is just figuring out, here are the advantages, here are the disadvantages. So here's a question that I have to those of you against it. What health price have we paid for genetically modified corn and genetically modified soybeans? If genetically modified has a bad impact on people's health, would we not have experienced that in the areas that we've already had genetically modified foods? So that's the obvious. Now, does it sound scary? Yes, it sounds scary to me. Does it sound beautiful, leave nature the way God made it? Yeah, but we don't leave nature the way God made it. We constantly change nature. And that's why God told us to, in fact, rule over nature. We're supposed to dominate it. God wants us to rule nature. and not have nature rule us, for those of you who would use the God made it that way argument. I don't find persuasive. The only persuasive argument that I can find is that it will do damage to human beings' health. I am human-centered. I am anthropocentric, as you would say, in my values, and I would like to know how it hurts people. And if it does, then I would be opposed to it. In the meantime, I just don't know. And all the various things that have been blamed for hurting people's health, we are living in the healthiest time in human history. People are living longer than ever. And all I'm told about is all the terrible dangers, from whether it's secondhand smoke or silicone breast implants or what have you, or for that matter, inoculations. Is there any truth? Yes, there's always any truth to any danger. There is some truth to the danger that exists of crossing the street, a particularly dangerous activity when you think about it. Crossing the street is a hell of a lot more dangerous than secondhand smoke. But I would not tell anybody, therefore don't cross the street. Life is a series of trade-offs. Okay, so much for that.
What we eat is very personal, but food is also social. And increasingly, food and agriculture are political. I'm pleased to have the opportunity to share with you today some of my thoughts about the future of food and the fight for where that future is going. Like everyone, I have a past that has shaped my perspectives. I grew up in a very small town in West Texas. In fact, there were 12 people in my senior class. I spent my childhood summers working in neighbors' cotton and soybean fields. And I can distinctly remember one hot summer afternoon standing in the middle of a cotton field, sun beating down on my sunburnt hands, calloused palms, with about a half a mile to go to the end of the row, thinking to myself, this is all the incentive I will ever need to finish college. And that's what I did. So I got degrees in food technology and later in agricultural economics. Along the way, I worked for county extension agents producing some of the first biotech cotton in that part of Texas. And I worked for food processors, sweeping floors and making sauces for restaurant chains like Chili's. I spent my life around the people who grow the food and manufacture the food we eat. And yet it seems that almost everyone is an expert on food these days. It's hard to turn on the TV or open up a magazine without seeing some cookbook author, journalist, or celebrity chef telling us that some new diet or farm policy or farming practice will solve all of our problems with food. What exactly are these problems? Well, let's turn to some of the critics of modern production agriculture. Yale professor Kelly Brownell tells us that we live in a toxic food environment. Best-selling author Michael Pollan wrote that Americans have a national eating disorder. And in a TED Talk about 5 years ago, Mark Bittman, who's a New York Times columnist and a cookbook author, showed a picture of a cow, an atomic bomb explosion, and then said that our modern American food production system is leading to a Holocaust of a different kind. In short, we eat too much sugar, too much meat, too much processed food, too many pesticides. Agriculture is too corporate, too monoculture, too subsidized. We're too fat, we're spending too much on healthcare, and we're living unsustainably. The prescription that's offered for these problems is local, slow, unprocessed, natural food. In many ways, it's a return to nature and an abandonment of modern production agriculture. But how accurate is this caricature of our food production system? Well, let's take a little quiz. Which of the following statements is true? A, obesity rates have significantly risen over the past decade. B, adoption of genetically modified crops has increased insecticide use. C, corporate farms have taken over agriculture and small family farms are struggling. Or D, organic apples are grown without pesticides. Actually, none of these are true. None of these are entirely true. They're false. Is it possible? Let's face it. You know, we humans, we're notoriously bad at judging relatively small risks. And is it possible that a lot of what you've read about modern food agriculture and perhaps even believe is wrong? I'm going to be honest with you. If I'm working out in my lawn and I come across even the smallest grass snake, I'm going to go running, screaming like a little girl in the opposite direction, even though I know that little snake can't do me much harm. It's just human nature to focus on the negative and the emotional. But sometimes these feelings can get the better of us. Let's take our quiz as an example. On obesity, according to an article in the Journal of the American Medical Association published this year, there has not been a significant rise in the rate of obesity among women in the last 12 years. And the same is true among men in the last 6. On GMOs, an article in the journal Science showed that the adoption of genetically engineered cotton reduced insecticide use by about 70%. The USDA has come to similar conclusions for corn and soybeans and has showed that even in cases where the adoption of genetically modified crops increases herbicide use, it causes farmers to switch to less toxic and environmentally damaging herbicides. On farms, the data reveals that 98% of all farms in this country are family farms, and 91% of all farms are small farms. There are more farms today than there were a decade ago, and the household income on those farms is higher too. And organics do use pesticides. They use natural pesticides, like copper and sulfur, which are often more toxic than the synthetic pesticides that farmers use. You know, we fret over the dangers of food pesticides, but the reality is that pesticide use in food is a relatively small risk in the grand scheme of things. Did you know you're over 15 times more likely to die from drowning in the bathtub than you are from the effects of food pesticides? Now, these are just a few examples, but when authors, NGOs, and government agencies require crises to sell books and secure funding and donations, there's a natural incentive to focus on only one side of the story. The result is that sometimes we can get distracted from the things in life that matter most. I worry about that small snake in the grass when I should be worried about keeping my kids from running out in the middle of the street. Now, I can understand if you want to avoid GMOs or pesticides or growth promotants in food. But let's not forget that it is more expensive to produce food without these technologies. And while you or I might be willing to pay to avoid these small risks in food, not everyone is so fortunate. Just because we have enough food to eat today doesn't guarantee the same for the future. Our food abundance that we've enjoyed is a triumph of human ingenuity over nature's indifference to us. What is natural food anyway? Did you know that the ancestor of modern corn was no bigger than your thumb? Americans had never eaten beef or pork or even wheat until the 15th century, and there was no such thing as Italian tomato sauce or Irish potatoes until after Columbus sailed the ocean blue, and yet we can scarcely imagine any foods more natural than these. But nature is not our friend. It's trying to compete with us. There is, after all, nothing more natural than dying. In about 2005, a chorus of cookbook authors were telling us that food in this country was too cheap. But little did they know that only a few years later, in 2008, that corn prices would more than double. As I speak, prices for corn are near their record levels. And the same is true for wheat and many other commodities. By turning our backs on the efficiencies of modern food technologies, is it possible that we may eventually be starving the very people we say we want to help? In our vexation over obesity, we seem to have forgotten that 15% of U.S. households, over 50 million Americans, are today food insecure. That's happening at the same time that a record number of Americans, 1 in 7 of us, are today on food stamps. Globally, the United Nations tells us that there are over 1 billion people in the world starving today. As recent history illustrates, falling food prices are not a guarantee. We have thankfully avoided the Malthusian nightmare so far, but as they like to say about stocks, past performance is no guarantee of future success. You know, Maslow's famous hierarchy of needs had a foundation, and eating is it. And yet we seem to have taken this triangle and turned it on its head. We want people to reach inner fulfillment and self-actualization with their food choices. But how can they do that when they're just hungry? Now, you may choose to avoid foods with modern technologies, but we should at least acknowledge the consequences of denying these technologies to others. Now, none of this is to say that there aren't problems with our food production system. There are. But a proper diagnosis of the patient is required before surgery is begun. And let's not forget the good. Because of the advancements in food technologies and agriculture, we have much more leisure time. Today, we spend 40% less time in food preparation and 81% less time in meal cleanup than we did in the 1960s. If that change doesn't sound good to you, go talk to your grandmother. And look around at the many millions of American women who are able today to work outside the home because food is so much more convenient. And we're eating better, too. We're eating 25% more fruits and vegetables than we did in the 1970s. We're living longer, 30 years longer than we did a century ago, and farmers are a lot more productive. Corn yields, for example, are up over 400% since the 1900s. But you don't have to take my word for it. Even the USDA tells us that food in this country has never been more nutritious, safer, providing fewer and less environmental impacts. And these facts are true even if we don't like to admit it. As John Steinbeck put it when he was traveling across America in the 1960s, even while I protest the assembly line production of our food, our songs, our language, and eventually our souls, I know it was a rare home that baked good bread in the old days. I want to open up alternative acceptable avenues for thinking about the future of food. My fear is that a worldview that celebrates naturalism as a core tenet is one that is inherently hostile to innovation and growth, even if they reduce poverty and bring about improvements in the health and environment. I don't want a future where my kids are brooding over how to grow the oldest heirloom tomato, but rather one where they're thinking about how to get corn to produce its own fertilizer, and where they dream about space-age technologies that can make tasty, nutritious food with the push of a button. Now, these dreams may never materialize, but they are destined to fail if we create a culture in which we can never imagine them. I'm rationally optimistic about the future of food. My hope is in the dynamism and innovativeness of farmers and ranchers trying to make a buck by selling us things we don't yet know we even want. I say let's get out of their way. Thank you.
Well, America's food industry has never been safer or of a higher quality than it is today. Yet that is not the image most people have in mind when they think about our modern food system. A growing number of Americans have a mistrust in modern food production that our guest today says is both unfounded and unhealthy. Economist Jason Luss studies consumer behavior and is the author of The Food Police and joins me now in studio. Well, first of all, you're going to have to explain to me, what is The Food Police? I've not seen any arrests, or at least as of late. Yeah.
So I sort of like to think about the food police as the backseat drivers when it comes to food, sort of a group of people that think they know better how you should be eating and how farmers should be farming. And even though they're a small group of people, they're very influential, they're cultural movers and shakers, and they've been very effective in getting the ear of politicians and advocating for policies that the research shows, unfortunately, in many cases, may do more harm than good.
Yeah, and you are a researcher. Let's just throw that out here. You write many scholarly articles. You've studied consumer behavior for several years.
That's exactly right. So I'm a professor of agricultural economics, and that in a lot of ways is what I'm trying to do with this book. The book is written for the general public, but what I'm trying to get people to do is sort of remember the science and the evidence-based reasoning and the economics behind a lot of the policies that get advocated, and not just do things because it feels good or sounds good, but let's look at the research and see if it's really going to work.
And you told me before you came out here that you wrote it to help, you know, provoke, but some of it people could say is provocative. I want to ask you about a couple of those things. First of all, fat taxes. That's something that we've heard a lot about, and I always want to get your opinion on taxing things that are not particularly good for us.
Right. So first, I'll start by saying that, you know, there are a large number of people in this country that are obese, and there is a problem with weight, and I'm not denying that issue. Part of what I question in the book, is it a public health problem or is it a private health problem? And there are certainly costs to being overweight, but it's not necessarily all that clear to me that it's a public health problem. But even if you disagree with me on that, and I think people can legitimately disagree, we might want to ask the question whether the policies we're advocating are going to work. And so let's take something like a fat tax, or let's take a soda tax to be even more specific. And that's something that's been advocated in a lot of locales. So the idea is, let's put a tax on sugar beverages, and this will lower people's weight. The trouble with that is, when you look at the research, that those taxes don't actually change people's behavior much. And even when it does, what people will often do is substitute towards other beverages, like they go from sodas to drinking juices, sometimes even alcoholic beverages. So they might even end up consuming as many or more calories than they did before. And moreover, one of the challenges is that it will raise revenue. It'll take money out of the wallets of consumers. And because poorer consumers spend a larger proportion of their income on food, food taxes are very regressive. What that means is it taxes the people who can least afford to pay it. So the research shows it's not going to actually change weight very much, and it's going to impose a cost on the poor. And so for those reasons, I don't tend to think about fat taxes being a very effective policy.
Now, how would you differentiate that with, you know, we regulate or try to incentivize smoking tobacco? We tax tobacco a lot in this country.
Yeah, we do. And, you know, I'm not going to claim to be an expert on cigarette and tobacco taxes. One of the things that's certainly different in that case is there are arguments that cigarettes impose costs on other people through secondhand smoke. So you smoking imposes a cost on me, and those taxes are sort of designed to get you to think about those costs you're imposing on others. It's less clear to me that that is the case with food. If you drink a large soda, that effect on me, it's unclear what effect that actually has on me. So I think there are important differences there.
I want to switch now to maybe from the consumer level to the producer level. And you talk a lot about in your book about production and some of the issues surrounding the caging of chickens or the farrowing crates that they use in pork production, and that you think maybe that regulation could be stepping over the line.
I think that's a really challenging issue, and I think a lot of consumers are legitimately concerned about animal production decisions. And for example, out in California, in 2008, there was a ballot initiative where Californians voted to ban gestation crates and cages used in egg-laying conditions. The challenge with that is that when you look at what consumers actually do in the grocery store, you find that, for example, less than 5% of consumers buy cage-free eggs or buy so-called crate-free pork. And so, in essence, by passing a law like that, what you're doing is forcing producers to adopt a more costly system that consumers themselves aren't willing to pay for. So it really puts producers in a real bind, in almost an unfunded mandate. I'm going to force you to make a change that I'm not giving you money to pay for. And so it puts producers in a real pickle sometimes. And I think, you know, I certainly have no problem with voluntary initiatives, with market initiatives of producers trying to sell cage-free organic varieties and earn a little extra return from that from the marketplace. But I think we've got to think about all the unintended consequences when we pass these kind of policies. And in California, one of the biggest effects of that policy might be that all California does is end up importing eggs from Arizona and Idaho, and the animal living conditions don't even change.
You mentioned in your book, and I think you actually quoted the CEO of Burger King asking why they don't sell more salads, and he said, well, because we can't sell our salads to our target audience. Is the consumer not king?
Yeah, I think that's part of the beef I have with some of the people I refer to as the food police, and they seemingly want food companies to be offering healthier, you know, varieties and alternatives. But food companies can only sell what consumers are willing to buy. And actually, that comment that I referred to in my book was one that was made about 10 years ago. But today, you know, if you go into McDonald's, for example, they have salads and they have wraps. And so when consumers start demanding healthier alternatives for themselves, you can bet McDonald's and Burger King are going to provide it. And so it's not really a question of looking, in my mind, of looking at food companies and saying, oh, you're nefarious. You're imposing on consumers these unhealthy alternatives, because because at the end of the day, it's the consumer that's demanding those products. And as consumers, you know, I think we do have to take a little personal responsibility for ourselves, and we can't just point the finger at other people.
Yeah, I think that's probably very evident in the debate that happened last year over what in the industry is called finely textured beef. But when it made news in the public, it was called pink slime. And it's the finely ground up beef that they use to add protein into their hamburger. And it was a consumer rejection to it that kind of caused the industry to take a step back, did it not?
It did. You know, that's a really a lot of things going on with that issue. But you're right. There was no regulation in that particular case. And that was, in a way, a voluntary response to consumer demand. And it does show you that when consumers want to make a change, food retailers and grocery stores, food processors will respond very quickly. Again, we can argue a little bit about whether the media presentation of that particular case was spot on, but that's a sort of a separate issue.
Certainly. And I guess that does take me to that point. What is the role that the media has played in our opinions about the food that we eat?
I think one of the real challenges for me as a researcher and as somebody that grew up around production agriculture is that what you see in the media are often the bad stories about food and agriculture. And when you look at the best-selling books about food or the food journalists, you get this impression that, boy, everything's just terrible, and farmers are raping their land. They don't care about the health of their food they're putting out. They don't care about the environment or their children, and food processors are just poisoning the food supply. And, you know, having worked with these people, having grown up around them, it just simply isn't true. And I think one of the challenges for the media is they're going to report what sells. Right. And the unfortunate reality is that bad news often sells better than good, and the unfortunate reality of that is it creates a distorted image in the mind of the food consumer, one that doesn't really reflect reality. And so that's one reason I wrote this book, is to try to remind people that there really have been a lot of really wonderful changes that have happened in food and agriculture, and to try to remind people of those good changes, and in part so that they don't enact policies that will reverse some of those really good benefits and changes that we're receiving and may not even realize it.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of those changes. And I really want to focus now on food technology that's come about just in really the past couple of decades. And probably first and foremost is what I call biotech foods. They also are called GMOs, but genetically modified foods.
Right. This is certainly one of the most controversial food issues. And again, when I mentioned sort of the food elite, the cultural movers and shakers when it comes to food, they demonize this technology. They say it's terrible. It's created all these bad outcomes. But if you really look at the research, this has really been a boon to both farmers and consumers in a lot of respects. So on the farm, the research shows that biotechnology has allowed farmers to use fewer pesticides. It's allowed farmers to use more environmentally friendly herbicides, so that the herbicides that are now used on the farms are much less toxic to the environment. Moreover, they're associated with things like conservation tillage practices, so they allow farmers to not plow the ground as often. So there are a lot of environmental benefits, and it saves the farmer time, and so it's an economic benefit to them. And to you and I, the food consumer, biotechnology has lowered the price of food. And while some people in that live in Berkeley or New York, maybe they can afford enough to pay a little more for food, and that's fine if they can do that. But we got to remember, there are a lot of people in this world today that can't afford enough to eat. In the U.S. alone, there are 15% of U.S. households that are food insecure. That means they have trouble getting enough food to eat. Globally in the world, there's almost 1 billion people, according to the United Nations, that are hungry. And so it still remains the case that these sorts of technologies that can allow us to improve yield while also improving environmental outcomes and improving and growing the world supply of food to meet up with the world population is still and remains a really important issue.
Do you think that type of elitism that you're describing there is a result of just the simple fact that less than 1% of the American public is actively involved in production agriculture, and many people are 2 and 3 and maybe 4 generations away from someone that actually worked on a farm?
I agree. I think that's a big challenge for people that are involved in production agriculture, is exactly the point you mentioned. And that is, they don't understand, for example, when you mentioned cages and chickens, why would you put a chicken in a cage? It sounds terrible. then you've got to remind them, well, chickens peck on each other, and that word pecking order comes from somewhere. And
sows roll over on piglets.
Exactly.
Okay. Yes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you know, meanwhile, there are real things called weeds, and there are real pests trying to eat that food you're trying to grow. And so some of those things sort of get lost in the translation when people haven't grown up around production agriculture. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't try to be responsive to consumer concerns and that we shouldn't develop technologies that try to address consumer needs. But it also means there needs to be, perhaps in the agricultural industry, more transparency, more discussion, more openness about what's going on rather than trying to hide.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned another issue that I at first blush, I have to take exception with, and it's localvorism. And I've done my share of stories, just have to admit, about what we here in Oklahoma call the farm-to-school program, trying to get locally produced food into our local schools. But you say maybe it's not as important as we may think it is?
So I have a bit of a nuanced view on that particular issue. So I first of all, like local foods. I go to our own farmer's market here in town. And so I think that's a wonderful opportunity for consumers to buy fresh produce and even for producers to be able to meet a growing demand for local food. What I take issue with in the book are people that want to subsidize those activities. So take a best-selling author, Michael Pollan. He wants to require schools and hospitals and even prisons source a certain percentage of their food from local sources. And so the question, when we want to start requiring things or subsidizing things, as an economist, I want to ask the question, like, where is the market failure? Why would we want to subsidize that activity? And we would normally want to look at arguments, like, is it somehow going to benefit the environment? Is it somehow going to benefit the local economy? Is it going to somehow benefit health? And what I do in the book is take each one of those issues and ask, is local foods really doing these things? And I think when I look at the research, it's really not. And so again, there's some private benefits I get out of local foods. It is tastier often. It's fun to go out and talk to somebody who produced your food, but it just simply isn't the case that it's probably better for the environment or necessarily better for health, especially talk about school children. If you want to maximize nutrition on a budget, one of the best things you can do is probably buy frozen or canned vegetables. And it's not even all that clear that it's better for the local economy, because those dollars you're spending, the more dollars you're spending on local food are dollars that could have been spent on something else. And you got to ask, what is that something else that I could have bought with those dollars I'm now spending on local foods? So anyway, I'll leave it to the viewers to read the arguments in the book. But I hope that I can sort of make the argument there that it's fine if you want to do it, but if you're going to use my tax dollars and you're going to force people to make other things, let's make sure we're making wise policy decisions.
Let's talk about obesity. I think probably the argument is probably what we're a third fatter than we used to be just a couple of decades ago. What is there a role that food production has in America's obesity?
So obesity is a really complicated issue. No doubt food is one part of the equation. But when you look back and look at all the factors that could potentially have contributed to the rise in people's weight, what you'll see is that it's a really complicated issue. And the rise in obesity is actually accompanied with a lot of really positive changes, too. That sounds crazy. But if you look at us today compared to the 1950s or 60s, we have more air conditioning today. We have less strenuous jobs. So unlike my grandparents, who often had to go out and work on the farm many hours a day, I sit in a nice air-conditioned office. I feel like it's a travesty if I can't get my air conditioning in the car to work. Our food is more convenient. We spend a lot less time in meal cleanup and in meal preparation. And we're able to drive more. All those things are really positive changes. Another positive change is we smoke less. Whenever you smoke less, you know, smoking is correlated with weight. People that smoke tend to weigh a little less. So there are a lot of changes that have happened that have been good that contribute to that rise in weight. And sometimes we kind of have to ask the question of whether, you know, if we want to weigh like we did in the 1950s, it might take a world that looked like it did in the 1950s. Now, that doesn't mean we can't think about maybe ways of improving weight and health, but I think it is useful to take a step back and ask how we got to the situation we're in.
Essentially a much more active world than what we live in today.
Right. In some ways, that's right.
Now, let me ask you about organic. You kind of put the organic argument in your sights. Is there a role for organic simply from a marketing perspective, if not from a health perspective? Because you say in your book, there's no proof that organic is any healthier.
Right. So you know, again, if you want to buy organic, and we buy organic occasionally at our house, I say go for it. But what I am trying to do with people is give them the facts that are presented in the scientific research so that you're making an informed choice. Because the reality is that organic is more expensive. It's often about twice as expensive. So making wise decisions means not only making healthy food decisions, but it also means spending our money wisely. So let's make sure when you double your grocery bill that you're getting some bang for your buck. And I try to present the evidence. And what I argue is that organics are not any tastier, which are based on lots of studies of blind taste tests. They're not any healthier in terms of nutrient content. Also, it's one misperception people have about organics is a lot of people believe they're produced without pesticides. That's not true. They use natural pesticides like copper and sulfur, many of which are more toxic than some synthetic pesticides. Now, it is true that if you look at the evidence that a lot of organics have a lower total level of pesticide use. And so the question is, how risky are pesticides in food? And I think that's a legitimate question to ask. And if you're really worried about that, maybe that's a reason to buy organic. But the evidence I present in the book is based on the science that these pesticides are really small risk in the grand scheme of things. And the last thing I point out is about the environment. And I do say in there that it is probably true that organic production is probably slightly better for the environment. But how much better? And it's more equivocal than most people realize. There are some advantages, like organic requires planting certain cover crops and not tilling the soil. But what we have to realize is a lot of conventional farmers already are no-till and care about their own land. Moreover, with organic, often the yields are lower. So if you want to produce the same amount of food, you have to bring more land into production. And pulling more land into production is not what most people would consider an environmental benefit. So, yeah, there might be some environmental benefits, but it's not as hyped as a lot of people make it out to be.
So would it be fair to say that you believe we may have too many regulations in our food system?
I think that's an argument I'm making, definitely so. And part of it is that I'm, especially a lot of the regulations people are proposing going forward, I think are a lot of what I'm arguing against. And so there are two things here. One is when we do propose regulations and we look at the ones we have, let's make sure the science, and not just the nutritional and medical science, but also the economic research supports those policies. And a lot of times they don't. And then secondly, there is a role for consumer choice and responsibility and freedom of choice. And I am guarding against a situation and a culture in which when there's any problem, we have to turn to the government for the solution. I think the reality is, just like we talk with those food companies, if you go in and say, I'm demanding healthier alternatives, I'm willing to pay more for this or that, they will respond. But you do have to be willing to pay more for it.
You know, I'm particularly troubled, though, and I remember the melamine scare, you know, and it wasn't a scare, it actually killed lots of pets and infants in China, that, you know, what happens when an upstart company, if there's not the regulation, and we may be importing some food that's just not good for us?
That's right. So it's, of course, true that companies have made mistakes and sickened people, and the unfortunate reality is no world is perfect. And in fact, no government regulation can prevent us from all harm. And even if they could, I don't know that we'd want them to, because it would be such a controlled world, a sterile world that we face. No, you know, if you don't want any risks in life, you just stay at home and close the door. But when you look at a company's incentive, let's take another one like Jack in the Box, for example, that had E. coli and made people sick. You know, they suffered a lot from that. Probably, I don't know the exact details, but they probably almost went bankrupt. I remember when that happened, and they were certainly suffering financially. And so companies themselves face a lot of incentives to make sure that they don't sicken the public, to make sure that they don't do things that they can be sued for or that can come back and shut them down. So there are a lot of private incentives for companies to think about public safety and health. And that doesn't mean there have never been problems. It doesn't mean there won't be problems in the future. But as long as there's competition and as long as there are legal remedies for you and I as consumers to punish companies when they do wrong, and I think that's an important part of it, then I think they will demand to respond to those concerns for safety, because you and I are concerned about them too.
Certainly, certainly, certainly. regardless of the personal cost when some of those things happen. Let me ask you this. If you could write a letter to the EPA, the USDA, and the FDA, any of those people, those regulating agencies, what would you tell them about American food production?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know. First of all, they're probably not going to listen to any letter that I sent them. But one of the things I think that when we think about food policy in general, one of the things that I think gets missed a little bit is that when we look at a lot of the problems with food, take obesity or environmental problems, a lot of times these are more symptoms than causes. So take the issue of obesity. Obesity is really, I think, often tied up with the problems of poverty. And when people live in an impoverished condition, they often don't have the incentives to think about their future self. They don't have the incentives to invest in their education and in their health because they don't have the expectation those investments are going to result in some positive outcome. And so a lot of times when we see things like unhealthy eating and obesity, that's a symptom of some larger underlying issue related to poverty. So really, if you're asking me about what things should government be doing to get people to eat healthier and think about their health, they're probably policies that would promote economic growth and policies that would give people the opportunities and the chances to benefit from investments in their health and in their education, because then they'll have an incentive to think for themselves about, wow, if I'm healthier 10 years from now, I'm going to be making more money. I'm going to have more opportunities. So in my mind, a lot of economic development and promoting a culture and an environment of economic growth is one that would do a lot to solve a lot of the health problems that we see.
All right. Well, it's certainly been an interesting conversation. Jason Lusk is an economist and a consumer behaviorist and the author of this new book, The Food Police.